Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Irish Studies, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. My name is Aidan Beattie. I'm one of the co-hosts of this channel. Today, we're joined by Dr. Justin Dolan Stover, Associate Professor of Transnational European History at Idaho State University, where he teaches courses on war and violence, modern Irish history, and the two world wars. He holds a doctorate in history from Trinity College Dublin and has also held several research fellowships throughout Ireland and is currently a research fellow with the Netherlands Institute for Advanced Study in Amsterdam, where I believe he's joining us from today. His new book, which we will be discussing, is entitled Enduring Ruin, Environmental Destruction During the Irish Revolution. Justin, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Aidan. Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with a very general question. We're now coming to the close of a long decade of commemorating and maybe over-commemorating the 1912 to 23 period in Irish history. And there's been a huge number of studies of this period written from a lot of different methodologies, whether military history or political history or gender history. And I wanted to start with a question that might sound kind of offensive. Why do we need environmental history? What does that do for us?
No, I think that's a great question. Certainly the field is crowded, and the decade of centenaries has actually, I think, invited more people to be writing on the period during its commemoration. I think environmental history brings something that politics and the military history perhaps have missed. And that is looking at the dynamics of revolutionary violence or revolutionary politics, maybe in a more decentralized way. I know that Ireland is very fond of county-based studies, particularly because of the ways in which the archive is organized. It really lends itself to a county-based study. But I think an environmental study of the period allows you to look at the everyday lives of individuals and how they were affected by revolutionary politics or violence, but also allows you to see the ways in which those politics and violence operated alongside environmental destruction, which very much impacted people's everyday lives. The methodology is one I think that was right out in the open in a lot of the material I looked at anyway, but was nevertheless one that's maybe been downplayed a bit. And by that, I mean, in police reports, for instance, at the county level, you often see reports of when, say, trees were felled in the same paragraph as you'd see news of an ambush. You'd see the ways in which roads were trenched to prevent pursuit by rebels and how this disrupted, say, market days or individuals just trying to get from place to place. So what an environmental view, I think, does is one way it looks at the dynamics of the violence that's taking place in a different way, but also it allows us to see perhaps another, I don't know, another way of engaging with the sources that have been so familiar to students of the period.
I mean, I know in my own study, in my own work, it's amazing how massively Irish nationalists talk about the space of Ireland and their hopes for what will happen to that space once it becomes independent and how it'll bloom and flower and things like that. And and are using very environmental language. So you start with the Easter Rising, and your analysis in that chapter combines environmental history in this broad sense, in which you mean kind of the history of space and urban history, and as well as ecology, with what you call sensory history. Can you talk us through what you're analyzing there?
Yeah, sensory history comes to the fore in the study of the Easter Rising, in the ways in which the Rising impacted the perceptions of Dubliners and of those who happened to be in Dublin at the time of the Rising. We don't have accounts that would be useful to environmental historians, such as the amount of CO2 that was released into the atmosphere during the fires that took, say, the GPO. But what we do have are intimate accounts of the ways in which landscapes were manipulated during the Rising, mainly for defensive positions of the rebels, but more impactfully by the ways in which Crown forces attempted to dislodge rebels from defensive positions. And it's through that and the use of artillery, which eventually begat fires, as did looting throughout the city, that really allowed the Easter Rising to become a sensory event. You have accounts of individuals who are dictating the scale and impact of the Rising based on, say, how much smoke is being observed in the sky, the smell of Dublin that changes while these fires are raging, the smell of death in many ways, both of animals and of individuals. This is a week-long endeavor, you remember. And so the smell of death and decay, as well as the sight of destruction, are all sensory inputs that I think give a different weight to the Rising to those who had observed it, for sure.
So you kind of continue in that way then when you move into the later chapters and into the War of Independence, when you talk about how, as you say, Republicans militarized civilian and commercial spaces. And then later on, you say the IRA enlisted the land as a native fifth column in their guerrilla war against Crown forces. So can you first of all tell us about the tactics that the IRA was using and how you can understand those tactics environmentally?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, the militarized spaces takes on a number of meanings and a number of phases of the revolution. And you can see a militarized space is really anything in which the nature and the composition of that space has changed, typically in ways that would have a military tone to it. So if there's a road blockade, say the Crown forces have erected in a town, barbed wire, sandbags, steel shutters on police barracks, this brings more of a militarized atmosphere, I think, to these previously civilian spaces, or at least civilian in a sense that they could be understood. But militarized spaces then become noticed during the War of Independence itself, in the sense that the IRA used the land as you mentioned, as its fifth column, as something that would perhaps offset the military might of the British Army in Ireland. And by that, I mean particularly transportation routes are altered through trenching, through tree felling, to prevent the pursuit by lorries full of soldiers or even soldiers on foot to corral them into spaces for ambush. This is noted on a massive scale, too big actually to pinpoint individually. But often in the record, you'll see IRA veterans refer to their activity as, continuously cutting trees or continuously trenching roads. The destruction of bridges is something that's quite significant as well. These little bridges that crisscross the many waterways, big and small throughout Ireland, alter the landscape, but then alter the mobility that's able to be used in the pursuit of rebels by Crown forces. In response to these manipulations of landscape and the violence that results through ambush, you then see the militarization of a greater militarization of cities and towns in Ireland through reprisal that's carried out by Crown forces, either in the form of curfews, of cancelled and restricted fares, and of wholesale destruction of towns that really militarize Irish landscapes, in the context perhaps of the wider First World War period, in which individuals came to understand destruction on the continent and what it might look like in Ireland.
So how then, if the IRA are being kind of clever or strategic in how they use the environment, how do British forces respond? Are they able to be as clever?
Maybe maybe not clever, but forceful in their use of individuals, civilians, actually, to refill trenches, to clear roads. Obviously, the civilians are under a great deal of pressure to report on the activities of the IRA. Civilians are also very much at the forefront of the receiving end of raids on the individual home, which changes the composition of a domestic space outright. And so the cleverness, I think you can see in the faces on some of the British soldiers that are in pictures in the insert of the book. There's smiles in their faces when they come across a felled tree. So they're not exactly happy about it, but they almost recognize the ingenuity in using the land in that way. But there's a great deal of civilian coercion that's used by Crown Forces and by the IRA to clear or retrench roads.
So you have this obviously like very Irish focus, right, within the book, in that you're literally looking at the spaces of Ireland and the land of Ireland. And yet you end by talking about the much bigger international context of this. So how do you balance the two of those? How do you do a history that's so focused on Ireland, but that has this international element to it also?
I suppose it comes during my time at Trinity in the about 2006 to 2011. I was very much under the influence of people like John Horn, who were talking about Ireland in the First World War in the greater context that we should perhaps view Ireland. And in that way, I looked at the destruction environmentally that occurred during the revolution, not on a par with anything that's happening in Europe. That's the whole point, I think, of the book, is to show that this is a non-industrial conflict, a guerrilla war that has its own very unique environmental impacts. But nevertheless, it's understood in a greater international context. The Easter Rising, I think, is the best example of this, because so many individuals who report on the sights, smells, and sounds that they experienced in the capital do so as a way of juxtaposing that with either what they've read or heard about what's happening in Belgium and France. And so to communicate the scale and the ferocity of damage, they turn to the greater European context that they would have been familiar with through newspaper reports. But the same can be said during the War of Independence period, where individual Irish towns that are destroyed, such as Cork or Balbriggan, are often compared to French and Belgian cities that were quite recognizable to individuals who were following the course of the First World War. And so to end on a more international note, I think for me is to place the destruction experienced in Ireland in that bigger context of the greater war that we can observe. But it's also a way to recognize the ways in which people on the ground would have perhaps, and indeed did, contextualize their own understanding of destruction at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I've always found it fascinating that when the rebels take Stephen's Green in Dublin during the Rising, the first thing they do is build a trench, which is one of the dumbest things you can do strategically. but they're clearly... they're thinking, well, this is what a war looks like, because this is what the Great War looks like.
This is what they're familiar with. And you're certainly right to say this is a very ill-advised move strategically. They're in the shadow of the Shelburne Hotel, and they're trenching into the ground, immobile, being overlooked by a higher position. So not principally the best military strategy, but certainly something that they would have been familiar with, absolutely.
So obviously, as you mentioned, this comes out of work you were doing at Trinity as a doctoral student. So where will you go next? Will you do more environmental history work?
You know, that's a great question. And it's something that I've been kind of toying around with in my head while I've been here in the Netherlands on this research fellowship. And I'd really like to pursue two projects that come out of the book I've just published. And the first is a history of the 1920s and 30s in Ireland regarding reconstruction and compensation and the restoration of landscapes. So I've spent this book talking about their destruction and their militarization. And I'd like to look at the ways in which reconstruction was prioritized in the wake of the Irish Revolution and in the early years of the Free State. And what we see, like we see in lots of European countries, say after the First World War, are problems with unemployment. The Irish have an unemployment problem, but they also have, in the files I've seen from the National Archives, solutions in the ways in which landscapes are being identified as places for work and for labor to be directed. You obviously also see the harnessing of the Shannon River and the hydroelectricity schemes in the 1920s. But other projects that I think are less known to students of the period, such as the massive afforestation projects that are talked about in government circles. And the planting of trees is kind of a way to cleanse Ireland of its colonial past as well. Ireland was significantly denuded of trees by the 20th century. And so the first project I'd like to see come on the tail end of the book is one that looks at restoration and compensation. And there's thousands and thousands of files on compensation for property damage to go through. So I won't have any problem with the work there. The other project, I think, is a broader environmental history of modern Ireland. This would take a little bit longer, but Irish scholarship is not necessarily lacking in environmental voice. I think there's some great people, Juliana Adelman, particularly. I've enjoyed her book on the 19th century animal in Dublin. But a general vibe of environmental history seems to be quite low in Irish studies. And so I think perhaps a larger, more ambitious project on looking at the environmental history of Ireland since the plantation might be a great introduction of the subject to students of Ireland.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that sounds like a massive but very important project.
Yeah, maybe a collected volume rather than an individual effort.
Sure. Well, if Enduring Ruin is anything to go by, it'll be a great book. And obviously, Enduring Ruin itself is a really fabulous piece of work. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you for having me.